Welcome to the Moss Island Sounds Podcast, Episode 3. I'm Chris Board. We're sponsored this week by Finelli Sound and Lighting, a Utica, New York production company that can help with your live sound and stage lighting needs. I've worked with a lot of sound companies. Joe Finelli is who I call when I need something, and you should too. Email me at chris.board@mac.com, and I'll get you Joe's contact information. In the news this week, Apple announced its new watch will be available for purchase on April 24th. This has prompted tech writers to scribble furiously about how this is a terrible move and who even wears a watch now, and the only people who will want this device are those too lazy to take their phones out of their pockets. Remember when the iPad was announced? All the feminine product jokes about the name, all the blah, blah, blah about how it was just a big iPod Touch. iPad is now synonymous with the tablet computer. Its name is like Kleenex, a brand name that people use for similar products. So, I find it puzzling that so many are on the same bandwagon again. I remember my father's first digital watch. He got it in 1978, a Commodore Business Machines Time Master. It had glowing red numbers that only appeared when you pressed a button. It was billed as a five-function watch, which is stretching things a bit. On one screen, it showed hour and minutes. Press the button again for month and day, and then again for seconds. The watch face was actually a magnifying lens. The internal LED was smaller. Now, the first digital watch was Hamilton's Pulsar in 1972. It sold for $2,100, which was more than some cars at the time. My father claims his CBM was several hundred dollars, and it might have been. By the end of the decade, similar watches were selling for $10. I've been using a Pebble watch for the past 15 months or so. It connects to my iPhone using Bluetooth and shows snippets of new email, text messages, who's calling, in addition to the time. There are hundreds of free watch faces available for the Pebble, which can be installed and swapped out in seconds. Having this kind of watch is great for quickly glancing to see if an incoming message or call is one you need to pay immediate attention to. It's not because I'm too lazy to pull out my phone. It's because I'm too polite to keep doing that. I think this might also help people who keep dropping their phones, maybe because they're pulling them out so often. Pebble has updated the software every few weeks since I got the watch, and it's become more reliable. Still, I'll probably upgrade to the Apple Watch at some point. Here's the thing about Apple stuff. Once you hold them, you want them. People who had no idea what the iPad could be good for changed their minds once they tried it. I was the same way. I couldn't see the point until I read a magazine on one. Then I discovered that I could use it to run lights and sound in the theater, and so on. The Apple Watch is going to be a success, for the reasons I listed, and with applications that haven't yet been thought of. Wait and see.
Why do you suppose I just hurled a chair at your head, Neiman?
I don't know.
Sure you do.
The tempo?
Were you rushing or were you dragging?
I don't know.
Start counting.
Five, six, seven.
In four, damn it! Look at me!
One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four.
Now, was I rushing or was I dragging?
I don't know.
Count again.
One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four.
Rushing or dragging?
Rushing.
So you do know the difference!
I once dated a double major, piano and clarinet, who attended Crane's School of Music. I worried about her. She'd compose rambling, semi-coherent letters after her daily 8-hour practice sessions, obsessed with the idea that she didn't have what it takes to be a musician. In retrospect, I don't think she did have it, which is a desire to make music, to collaborate, to express herself, and convey some essence to an audience. Damien Chazelle's Whiplash is like one of those letters, anxious and missing the point. Its desperate energy creates the illusion that something impressive is happening, but what it really taps into is the exhausted uncertainty of a certain kind of student. The movie begins badly, with a pretentious, portentous, slow tracking shot approaching Andrew, played by Miles Teller, as he practices. He's trying to play faster, and one might leave the movie thinking that speed is a drummer's only goal. J.K. Simmons, whose jagged temple vein won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor, plays sadistic teacher Fletcher, who insults, assaults, and plays psychological games with his students to bring out depths of talent they never knew they had. Right. Chazelle, who also wrote the screenplay, has Fletcher repeat and repeat an apocryphal story about how Joe Jones threw a cymbal at young Charlie Parker's head, nearly decapitating him. Supposedly the event that inspired Parker to practice harder and become Bird. Not quite. Jones purposely dropped a cymbal on the floor when Parker lost his place in the music. Music teacher as drill sergeant is undoubtedly how some teachers are perceived by their students, but the movie never gets beyond it. By the end, Chazelle would have us believe that Fletcher has finally created his Bird by pushing Andrew further and, of course, faster than he knew he could go. Alan Parker is another director who's made several high-energy music films with no music in their souls, particularly Fame from 1980. As I watched, I jotted a note that Whiplash is the movie Parker was trying to make when he shot Fame. It's not a compliment. Chazelle's musical sensibility is better matched to his material than Alan Parker's was, and he has a brilliant technical team to help with the illusion that music is happening. Tom Cross's editing and Craig Mann, Bill Wilkins, and Thomas Curley's sound mixing deservedly won Oscars. The problem is that Chazelle doesn't have a film artist's sensibility. He's a hack. He stacks the deck with plot contrivances, lost music folders, forgotten sticks, flat tires that amp up the tension, but conflate the difficulties of becoming a musician with the difficulties of being an everyday human being. More than music, Chazelle wants his Rocky-esque climax, where the hero comes back against all odds and shows everybody what he's made of. If one considers Whiplash a grand guignol music comedy, it almost works. Sharon Mir's cinematography is brilliant toward that end. The queasy greens, floating heads, copious blood porn. Not only tattered hands shoved into ice water, but smashed bleeding faces and countless drops dancing on hi-hats and tom heads.
Andrew, what are you doing, man? I'll cue you.
Even Chazelle's finale works in this frame. What was unintentionally funny, a ridiculous drum solo, works perfectly as masturbation that finally produces, yes, climax for both Andrew and Fletcher. When the screen cut to black, I wished for the sound of a match lighting a cigarette as the credits rolled. Miles Teller was impressive in The Spectacular Now, and he's apparently really a drummer, but I didn't believe him here. He's too laid back, with too little connection to his fellow musicians. There's never a sense that he comes to life when playing. It looks like he's trying to pass a kidney stone. That might have been interesting if Andrew ultimately decided he didn't have the music in him. But the movie wants us to believe that if he just tries harder and plays faster, he'll make it. Paul Reiser has exactly one good scene, his first in the film, where he conveys easygoing humor as Andrew's dad. Things go downhill in an awkward family dinner scene lifted from Saturday Night Fever, where Dad can't defend his son against buffoons who don't understand why music is better than football. At least Reiser fares better than Melissa Benoist, seen by Andrew and the writer-director as female distraction from potential male greatness. Benoist is quite good and is almost allowed to make an impression, but Chazelle really isn't interested. Here's Chazelle's thesis. There are no two words in the English language more harmful than good job. That sounds like a great sentiment. It echoes The Incredibles, which posits that nobody is special if everyone is. But Whiplash never stakes out a coherent point of view. Presuming Andrew's climactic drum solo is great music, does it mean that great music blossoms from deception and abuse? Does more effort, more speed, more blood equal great art and ultimately justify Fletcher's tyranny? My gut says no, and the movie sometimes leans that way. Maybe it depends on how much Andrew's last solo turns you on. I think Chazelle believes it, and some of the audience raves suggest that people are with him. I prefer Chazelle's original 18-minute short film, also called Whiplash. It has all of Fletcher's bigoted, face-slapping, cymbal-throwing tyranny, but it ends before the music begins. The feature-length movie has great cinematography, mixing, and editing, which add lots of sound and fury. But there's still no music.
There was a moon out in space, but a cloud drifted over its face. It kissed me and went on your way. The night we called it a day.
Don't trust the haters. A quick perusal of internet commentary about Dylan's latest reveals a lot of reduction. Dylan does Sinatra. And snark. They couldn't get the Chipmunks for a Sinatra album, so they got this guy. The songs on Shadows in the Night are gorgeous, and they stand on their own. But that's from someone with 371 Bob Dylan songs in his library, and 412 by Sinatra. AARP published a long interview with Dylan that serves as a primer for those who don't see the connection. Dylan has said these songs have been with him for a long time, in some cases his entire life. Like Sinatra, Dylan believes a singer needs to understand the words before they sing. He says that's the distinction between singing to an audience instead of at them. Dylan's version of Autumn Leaves bears out the point. It's stunning, arguably richer in meaning than Sinatra's version, if not as conventionally pretty.
But I miss you most of all, my darling, when autumn leaves start to fall. The
arrangements on Shadows in the Night are nothing like Sinatra's versions, which Dylan says he reveres. These are stripped-down acoustic interpretations, recorded live with no overdubs and minimal processing. Dylan's voice isn't smooth, he wobbles all over the pitch, but he sings true, to borrow a phrase. There was plenty of bile spewed at him when he plugged in back in 1965, but he sang the hell out of those songs, too. That's why reductive templates don't work with Dylan, or any true artist. His electric rock was significantly different than his folk songs, which were both different than his country songs, his gospel songs, etc. But his vocal instrument has always served the music, and it does here as well. I doubt anybody listening to 90-second preview snippets of these tracks will be impressed. I'll bet none of the one-star reviewers on iTunes listen to the entire album. It helps to know the songs ahead of time, to read about why Dylan chose them, and how he approached recording them. It also helps to review your favorite Dylan tracks, to place the new music within his canon. Then sit down, listen to a few numbers in their entirety. Autumn Leaves and What'll I Do are standouts. The weakest track is Some Enchanted Evening, which is far removed from Dylan's lyrical sensibility. He also mangles the vowel sound on the word stranger and gives the song a too insistent beat. Shadows in the Night is an intriguing and worthy addition to Dylan's discography. It should be heard as a piece. The entire album becomes richer the more you experience it.
What'll I do when you are far away and I am blue? What'll I do? What'll I do when I am wondering who is kissing you? What'll I do?
Last week, I read a piece about my first crush. This is about my first love. I learned because of Facebook that she died in 2010 at 42, leaving a husband and two small boys. I sent him a note with my condolences, knowing it was weird. I told him that she'd formed my musical sensibility. He was generous and thanked me for the kind words, but he knew exactly what I meant. Kim liked certain music, and because of that, you ended up liking it too. I originally wrote this piece as part of a short story, with all the names changed, as well as some of the events. When I found out she died, I changed them back and made sure everything was as true as I could remember. This is for Kim. Stay with me a while. Said you give me life, but you never told me about the fire. It was just before 4 a.m., and the house was quiet, except for my brother snoring in the bunk above me. I hadn't slept well, but I don't tend to sleep well when the world is coming to an end. Why bother? I looked at the clock again, and maybe the hands had moved backward. I knew what I had to do, even as I dreaded doing it. There was no choice, and my heart rattled, and I was sure that I would wake everyone in the house. I rolled out of bed, grabbed the old red sweatpants with a white stripe I'd left where I could find them in the dark. Blood rushed to my ears, and for a moment, I thought I'd pass out. Maybe that would be better, except someone might find me in my clothes and wonder what I'd been up to. I'd oiled the window's glides again the night before to make sure it would open silently. Gently undid the latch and lifted. The air still smelled like summer, even if tomorrow, today, was the first day of school. I wasn't ready for ninth grade. At least, I wasn't ready to face it without her. We'd met after my debut performance in the middle school production of Oliver. I was a 13-year-old Bill Sykes, if not the terror of London, then certainly of our tiny stage. I'd grown my hair long, as I figured old Bill might have done, and I didn't wash it for a week before the performance. My inspired take on the character was to shout all of my lines, raging and spitting at my fellow actors and at the audience. On opening night, I experienced a double shock that would color much of my subsequent experience. The first surprise came when I'd re-entered the stage for my bow, fresh with some fake blood I'd smeared on my temple to show the audience exactly how I'd perished during the play. Stepping out from the curtains and into blinding light, I was unprepared for the erupting sound of cheers and boos from the crowd. Those and also the sound of girls shrieking. Now that was a sound I'd heard when I saw a documentary about the Beatles on PBS. For me? I remember thinking right then, this is one of life's highlights, and there won't be many better than this one. So far, so true. Afterward, I was in the dressing room, actually the band rehearsal room, hiding behind the timpani as I changed my clothes. The air was riotous with teenage boy sounds, shouting, laughing, farting, and all that. Ted Berger, the real star of the show and my imagined rival, came in and yelled, "Borden, someone out here wants to meet you, and I think you're going to like her." Whoa. That was the ultimate summons from Ted, who was in a league beyond the rest of us. He'd been dating a ninth grader all month, and it was rumored that he'd gotten to third base. I didn't really know what the bases represented, but third was something we aspired to. He had a weird grin that seemed at once mocking and impressed. I was so taken aback by his invitation, I went through the door without realizing I'd left my pants on the drums. Even 30 years later, I remember the scene and how it felt. Sparkling eyes so brown, I couldn't tell where the pupils ended and the irises began. Dark, curly hair. Sweater-encased breasts that made me suddenly aware of what all the fuss was about. Braces. Shiny lips smiling. I smelled vanilla. My awareness narrowed, and it seemed there was nobody else in the hall except the two of us. I had a difficult time hearing Ted's voice, which might have been coming from the next room. "Chris Borden, this is Kim Morgan. She enjoyed the show." Show? What show? I gradually became aware that someone was laughing. Everything returned in a rush, and I became aware of something else. Authority. "What are you doing out here with no pants on? Why are these people backstage? Get out of here!" I was saved from needing a response by a loud, wet raspberry sound followed by new peals of hilarity. A bare bottom was thrust from the boys' changing room with two words crudely smudged across the pale skin, "Bite me." This distracted the teacher long enough for me to grab Kim's hand and pull her out of the hall into the wings of the now dark theater. As the doors closed behind us, I could hear Mrs. Bordage yelling at Ass Man, probably Jim Root, resident joker, "You think I've never seen anything like that before? I'm a married woman, buddy. Let me tell you, I've seen better than what you're showing." Silence where we were. In a moment, outside of time. Leftover heat and sweat in the dusty curtains. Vanilla, I would love the theater forever. Hi. Hands clasped together. Nothing spoken for a long time. I was in new territory and figured maybe this is heaven. Fast forward 7 months. In that time, I'd expanded my knowledge of so many things. Love, kissing, breakups, reconciliations, the politics and strategies of dating, the mechanical difficulties of underwire bras. I'd loved and hurt more than I thought possible, and everything had ended on the final night of summer, our last moment together. Her family was moving to Connecticut, impossibly far away, and we'd never see each other again. I'd known it was coming since the beginning of summer, but summers last forever when you're young. Now everything was over. I lifted one leg through my bedroom window and held the sill with both hands. I shifted my weight and pulled my other leg through, lowered myself until I was hanging from the window edge, and I found the edge of the porch roof with my right foot. It was harder to get back in than it was to get out because I needed to jump a short distance back to the window edge and use upper body strength to pull myself back into the room. There were a few black scuffs under the window where my feet dragged in the past, scrambling to get my body high enough to regain leverage. Once I'd even dropped into the lilac bush below, snapping several branches and scraping myself in the process. My parents had noticed none of the evidence, as far as I could tell. From the roof, it was a short drop to the wooden railing below. Then the ground, and I was home free for a while. The danger was in leaving and again upon returning. Once gone, the time was mine without immediate consequence, regardless of whether my absence was discovered in the meantime. I jogged a bit to make sure I wouldn't be late. Part of me knew it was pointless. There wasn't anything to be late for, and I was foolish to expect otherwise. The air was cool and damp with the promise of autumn. There was a thin mist hanging a few feet above the ground. Streetlights cast amber pools through which I ran. On that first night, Kim and I had attended the cast party together. She didn't mention that I had no pants on, even when I'd had to leave her sign to retrieve them from the band room. On my way back out, I looked in the mirror and saw long, greasy hair over a face covered in smeared makeup and eyes that burned with a passion I'd never seen before. I did not recognize this new version of myself. At the party, Kim and I were inseparable. I wasn't interested in food or music or anything else except her face, her eyes, and her hands in mine. Our first kiss was technically my second kiss ever, but it was my first real one. I'd had a girlfriend who'd broken up with me because I'd been afraid to kiss her. Despite 3 weeks of scheming, the best she'd gotten from me was a quick, desperate brush of the lips as we said goodnight on our front steps, and we were finished the next day. My issue wasn't with the concept of kissing. I simply had no idea what to do once the kiss started. That night, Kim took care of everything for both of us. We were sitting on those institutional school chairs, the ones that weigh 50 pounds and can survive a 3-story drop from a biology classroom window. And I turned to say something inconsequential. She was close, and she pulled my face into hers. Open mouths connected. Juicy fruit. I hadn't tasted it before, and when I smell it now, I experience a momentary out-of-body sensation. I felt her tongue on mine, and again the rest of the world faded away. The difference this time was the electricity. We stayed locked together for a minute, or maybe an hour, and just when I began to wonder about breathing, I broke the connection. And as I did, I saw Ted double over in laughter. Mrs. Bordage stood immediately behind us, and when Kim and I leaned back to look at her, she edged her hip between us and slid our chairs apart. I liked Mrs. Bordage, but I'd never been reprimanded in school before. Now I'd been in her sights twice in the same evening, which didn't bode well for the rest of my year in her science class. Mr. Board, Miss Morgan, I don't want to have to ask you to leave, but please be aware that there are young people present. Come to think of it, you both still qualify as young people. Let's engage in some more constructive pursuit, shall we? The art of conversation, perhaps. Ted. Board, you're out of control! I'd been prepared for some level of humiliation, but Ted's reaction signaled the rest of our group to not only approve, but to express awe at my exploits. That was cool. Definitely one for the books. Can I be next? Kim whispered in my ear, you're a great kisser. How's that for the art of conversation? She was out of my league. Her crowd was cool. I wasn't, notwithstanding Ted's recent acceptance of me. For some reason, she adored me. Gratefulness drove me to unprecedented lengths to earn her love. I wrote endless letters filled with poems and songs. I spent hours creating mixtapes. I baked for her, and I washed her father's car. She taught me about music. By default, I'd been an adult contemporary fan my entire life. My parents didn't listen to anything else, and it never occurred to me that there were options. The first LP record that I'd purchased had been Barry Manilow's Even Now. She taught me how to attend parties. She used two of those occasions to break up with me, demonstrating something else I'd never considered, the safety of crowds when negotiating troublesome relationship issues. On other occasions, she patched things up again. No big deal for her, but terrible, invasive surgery on my heart. Kim also taught me how to sneak out of the house. On weekdays during that summer, she'd had to babysit her brother, so our daytimes were curtailed. Instead, two or three times a week, we'd meet at 4:30 a.m., halfway between our houses. So far, I'd never been caught, although she hinted that her parents knew what she was doing, and I wondered if mine knew too. At 4:28 a.m., on the first day of school, as I reached the street we'd met on so many times before, I slowed to a walk. I called out to her in my mind, trying anything. She'd said that we couldn't meet because everyone in her house was going to be up early, packing. Our goodbye the night before had been awful, the worst ever, because something other than her whim would now separate us completely. I was ready for the long-distance relationship, anything to keep the embers burning. I'd bought postage stamps the previous day and a stack of cards from the Hallmark store. I was as ready as I could be, but I couldn't let her go. "Please meet me tomorrow morning. We can do it earlier." "I can't. Kiss me goodbye." "Please." We'd kissed. It was 100th time and the first. I put everything I had into that moment, and then I cried the entire trip home on my bike. In front of my house, I misjudged the curb, and I flew over the handlebars, landing in a heap on my front lawn. One last time, one last morning. It was impossible that she'd be there, but I needed to be. No way was I going to spend the rest of my life wondering what might have happened. In the distance, through the mist, a shadow. As my pulse raced, the shadow materialized into a figure, still too far away and too dark to see clearly. Even so, every part of me knew it had to be her. Afraid to break the spell, I didn't run. We met, as we always did, at the same time and at the same spot. I'd never believed in magic until that moment. Hi. You can find more essays and criticism at mossislandsounds.com. We're on Facebook and Twitter as Moss Island, all one word. Email me at chris.board@mac.com. Thank you for listening. Until next time. The original writing from the Moss Island Sounds podcast is owned by Chris Board and Moss Island Sounds, copyright 2015. Unauthorized use and or duplication of this material without express and written permission from Chris Board is strictly prohibited. Excerpts and links may be used provided that full and clear credit is given to Chris Board and Moss Island Sounds with appropriate and specific direction to the original content.